Hello and welcome to Label Sessions Presents, the podcast where we talk to the most interesting people about all the things you need to know in the worlds of innovation, business, design, tech, and culture. I am Fazlin Iso down in Cape Town, South Africa. And today we're welcoming three brand new label mates to the Expert Network roster, as well as being joined by Label Sessions founder Nick Sherrod. Nick, what are we looking at this week?
So this week we want to talk about the future of sportswear, which is maybe a big topic, but a kind of interesting one for that sector, but also for a lot of other sectors, perhaps, to look to as to where some of the innovation might be coming from. We also want to talk around how innovators can sometimes tap into their past to unlock where the future might be. And then we want to talk through a big topic, I guess, in some ways as well, but in terms of how can you think through the implications of big shifts in technology, given some of the slightly mind-bending updates that have come through recently around quantum computing in particular. But it's a bit more in the round. If you're leading innovation or you're leading a company, how can you think through some of the big shifts in core technology that are coming down the line?
Amazing. Thanks, Nick. We're also joined by Kishe Kehano, who is all things Label Mate roster here at Label Sessions. Kishe, what can we expect from Label Mates this week?
I think it's really exciting that I think this week and kind of in kind of the past few weeks, we've just launched three new accelerators that have been kind of directed by three of our Label Mates. We have a brilliant one that's all about kind of sonic branding with Vincent Corver. We have just launched one about kind of cyber innovation with Jez Goldstone. And then also kind of our latest one is all about kind of consumer duty with Ravi Bala. And, you know, throughout the whole process, we've kind of jumped on a few kind of podcast episodes and kind of have a bit of a deep dive into what to expect, where they're seeing things in their space, which has been sort of super interesting conversations and stuff that, you know, I'm not in that world, so it's everything is kind of new. But people who are also in that world can perhaps get a kind of a few insights here and there from that, and then perhaps kind of hopefully start new conversation on that. So, I mean, that's all been released, so hopefully people have already listened to that. But if not, you know, there's always kind of good listening things to kind of jump in.
But if not, we're judging you. Basically, we're saying if you haven't caught up on the episodes, then like that's, you know, I just haven't done your homework, you know.
Like to clarify that only Nick is judging you. The rest of us are. As mentioned, we're joined by three brand new Label Mates who've just joined the roster. First up, we have Rashid Gado, who's been busy democratizing digital payments across sub-Saharan Africa and is a pioneer in the digital payment infrastructure in West Africa, who's been enabling seamless, scalable solutions that uplift both businesses and communities, most notably for Visa. Rashid, what are you excited about right now when it comes to the payments landscape?
What we're seeing, I mean, in line with what we're saying, you know, the shift we're seeing in technology is, you know, it has been traditionally financial institutions that we used to interact with a lot, you know, banks, established entities, regulated, etc. But the thing with technology is then you start seeing young people just having some ideas in some issues in their communities that they want to fix. They have access to technologies, the technology, right? They can code things and start, you know, rolling out some new products. But then guess what we're seeing across the market is some of them, in only 1 or 2 years, are even, you know, solving issues, having tractions more than traditional financial institutions. So as an entity, then if you want to stay in your traditional model, where you have, you know, the partners that you're comfortable with, etc., then you'll probably be left behind, right? So then there is that constant thinking about what is going on in the market, how are people embracing technology, how are they solving for challenges, and then how you as an entity, you have an established framework, how you interact with people, then try to adapt, adjust, to also be able to, you know, provide to these also services without compromising, obviously, you know, whatever regulatory issues, concerns are there, you have to satisfy that. But at the same time, so that you come and you capture whatever opportunities there to push them as well to have the maximum reach possible. So that's what we do every single day. Even today, you know, we've been in discussions, etc. But again, when you say that, obviously it's not that easy. You know, we're smiling here on the call, but you have some challenges that you have to cross every single day. And you think that maybe you're done and then something will pop up. Then you have to sit down and then brainstorming, fix them, give the comfort to the stakeholders. Because sometimes because the unknown, people are just afraid sometimes because they don't know. These are young people just out from school. They don't have an established entity. So how would you trust them, especially when it's in the financial industry? So which means they're touching money, you know. So how do you ensure that the person will not get money and then run away? So there are all those concerns. You need to give comfort to the entire stakeholder that we need to also manage on a daily basis. But it's really exciting when you see down the road the impact, right? And when you look at the news, some of them have become like big entities, and then when you see the funds, they're able just to also live there across the globe. People are investing in them, trusting in them. So that's fulfilling, and now you're also part of that journey.
100%. I think with emerging markets, it's quite nice to see the change happen so quickly because it doesn't have the constraints of traditional models. Also joined by Javier Vargas with 14 years at Google, leading UX research across YouTube, Google Ads, Google Cloud, and Google Play. Javier has been at the forefront of designing user-centric experiences for billions of people. Javier, where do you see UX and innovation heading next?
Well, it is an interesting time because, as we all know, like AI is changing a lot of things. And I would say it's like we're in this phase of AI hype, which happens often when you get new developments. You fall into this hype phase where there's like a lot of money is being invested in that new technology, and it's being used in all kinds of useless ways. And which means that the field is just trying out what is possible without really starting to think with the users first. This happened multiple times across the history, so that's nothing new. And we're right in this now where a lot of applications of AI are rather useless for users. But the field of UX has an important contribution to make here because we have been traditionally always strong in helping people focus on user problems. And in cases where you achieve that, when you can start with a user problem and say, like, well, these are problems that need fixing, and then you can start which of these problems might benefit from AI, and then you can actually experiment how you can use AI to fix some of those problems, then that's where the magic happens. And I think we're right at that phase. We're slowly moving into this, and actual reasonable user problems are being tackled, and that's super exciting.
Amazing. Thanks. Oh, yeah. And finally, a big welcome to Rob Andrews, brand strategist and designer, renowned for breathing new life into legacy brands and crafting compelling narratives, from rebranding global institutions like the British Museum to reimagining the identity of Estée Travel. Rob, what are some of the questions brand leaders should be asking themselves right now?
This sounds terrible, but they should be asking themselves why they're making so much content. With their hand on their heart, they should be really thinking about what's the purpose of everything that they make. Yeah. There's a real kind of throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks kind of mentality at the moment, which says that all content is good content. And I think there'll be a natural reaction to that at some point, inevitably, where we will step back and go, I actually would quite like a film crew working on this one, or I would like a script writer, or I would like to place my advert rather than take the risk of where my advert will end up because it's in the hands of social media. I think it's like a stampede of horses, and everybody's just been really happy to run with that stampede of horses. And I think smart brand builders are going to start reining that back in.
That's incredible. That's a nice way to think about it. Are you making content just to make content? which I think is
a bit. Are they even making the content, or is just AI generating a lot of plugs? Oh,
that's a good question. That's a good one.
Oh, so Javier, you get the first mention of AI prize for this.
I'm happy to take that one.
We'll all be jumping on the bandwagon by the end, don't we?
Fantastic. So it's been a really busy week. One of the standout sort of news items has been Nike teaming up with Skims to create Nike Skims. And this is a new approach to the way we're doing sportswear. It's combining shapewear, sportswear, and it's taking Nike into a completely different audience. What do we think when we look at these, and you know, we can call them legacy brands. What do we think when you think of these new verticals for traditional sportswear? Could the future of sportswear start to look very different with these types of collaborations? I'll go over to Rob, because I think...
There's a weird thing that Nike might just have managed to grab the Kardashians just as they've hit peak Kardashian and are starting to go down the other side of the slide. It's always going to be a big danger with Nike that whoever you and you know with Adidas as well and all the other big brands. That whoever you align yourself with, you align yourself with just the wrong person at just the wrong time. It's weird. Where Nike have been super smart is so there's a dumb thing about Nike, which is Bill Bowerman at Nike famously invented jogging. He didn't. He found somebody else who was jogging, went, you know what, I think there's money in that. And still 40% of Nike's profits come from running shoes. They aren't going to find the answer outside of Nike. The answer to where Nike should be going is within Nike. You know, they probably had exactly the same hit 20 years later when they thought, you know what, basketball's going to be big.
Hmm.
They understand sport brilliantly, and they make a lot of money out of shoes. It just feels like this is kind of it's fireworks to grab the attention, but actually, is it core Nike business? I'm not sure.
Interesting how kind of where they're going with, you know, aside from Skims being the whole kind of Kardashian brand, I think they're really kind of tagging on to the whole kind of women in sports thing as well, and almost going at it from that kind of angle. You have kind of the kind of Formula One racing of launched the kind of all women series, and kind of there's lots more talk about, you know, the Olympics just happened with the kind of females in kind of maybe kind of the track stars when they're wearing different things when they're running, or like the tennis stars when they're kind of playing tennis, they're people talking about what they're wearing. So I don't know, maybe looking at this is perhaps kind of Nike going for the kind of other talking point that seems to be building up. I'm not sure if there's longevity in that, but I think it's a super interesting thing that they're kind of tagging onto, whether it's a trend or something longer.
But I think they've got to turn the conversation around to being a Nike conversation. So it's got to become about technology, the technology of sport. It's got to become about improving performance, or, you know, or getting more people out doing some kind of activity, which is like proper Nike territory.
Or aspiration as well. I think that's the thing as well, as interesting with sportswear as a category, is there's so much around, it's not so much what you need as such as what you aspire to be that you can buy into through those products. I think it was interesting, I think one of the other things we put in the show notes was that Allbirds example where they had the zero carbon shoe. I kind of find it interesting in terms of, you know, sportswear as a category is kind of, it's all about aspiration. And it's also one of the few areas where so brands put a kind of really confident vision of the future out into the world and kind of go, this is what we think is kind of interesting as to, maybe to some degree, Nike Skims is like a really almost tactical response to all of this. Because actually what brands in this space have historically done is kind of claim a vision of the future and say that this is what we want to be, or we want you to be. And if you just buy the sneakers, you can kind of buy into this in some way.
But what is the future? But like, what is the vision? in that case of Nike? Can you phrase that? What is the vision with this collaboration? What is the future?
I think that's true. I think that's really true, which is it seems to have got a lot of really warm welcome in the branding media. But actually, there isn't really a big aspiration here. And in particular, it's interesting as to, well, as you know, also whether there's a big aspiration globally here. Because this feels like, well, certainly in the UK, it feels very right now, right? Like it's a very good thing to do tactically right now. It's probably the same if you're in the US. I don't know if this is something that the whole world's going to get excited about in the same way as the whole world got excited about Nike at certain times and certainly certain sportswear brands at certain times.
Sorry, Fosun. Just one reflection. So look, I'm not an expert in that, etc. And when I look at even when I checked, I read, you know, some of the articles. I don't believe, as Nick is saying, that they're coming in this way in Africa. But I found it interesting that there is that collaboration, right? You know, being one year the footwear, the other one in the style and all that, and coming together to build. But in that sense, I really see that this is a smart, whatever we believe it is, I mean, that's the expert will say, you know, but for me, just taking a minute to realize that maybe there is an opportunity for me, a segment that I need to address, that I could have done it myself, build it myself, but just realize that maybe partnering be maybe easier or maybe faster to get whatever goal I have. And for me, that only is smart, especially when you look at Nike and their size they have. Sometimes, you know, they're just proud enough to say, I can do whatever I want. You know, everybody knows me across the globe. But then just take a minute to say, let me step back. And there is this area, maybe the women's side that I want to address, you know, in the sportwear, et cetera, different sizes. But let me just find one that schemes, you know, doing that already maybe well and partner it together. For me, that's a huge, you know, step for companies that size to be able to step down and say, let me think and then have a partnership. I found it interesting.
And it's also a good point, Rashid, that so far we've been talking about, is this a smart move for Nike? Which is fine. Yeah. But Skims, this is a hell of a power move. They've not even been acquired, right? This, for the Kardashian empire, this is an incredible deal.
Yeah, I mean, Nike's taking the bigger risk here. That's for sure.
Although Skims have got their positioning just perfect, haven't they? So in terms of they're very inclusive. They are, they're seen as being a brand with a moral purpose. So they're doing all the right stuff. So you can see why the partnership makes sense.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, moral purpose, because they're seeing as being like for a certain group of people.
Yes.
I think that's an interesting thing. I think there's a really interesting space just now where a lot of kind of ethical brands, I think, are falling a bit flat in the world. And I think it's because they say a nice thing, but nobody really knows who they're for. Whereas Skims, Allbirds to an extent as well, have this kind of thing where it's quite clear who their community is and who they stand for and how you can buy into it versus, you know, what are the other brands that kind of goes, hey, we've got a new green initiative or something, or has a new campaign in that space. It's actually like a, you know, there's something quite tangible you can buy into if you buy into Skims and buy into Allbirds.
So one of the other things that's been happening is we're seeing some of the biggest brands, the biggest sort of traditional brands, breaking into new categories over the last sort of week. Coke is doing a prebiotic soda, which is interesting. We're seeing innovation and we're seeing nostalgia and lore being brought to the runway. Is it the return to using faces in a different way? Traditional pubs being used as sort of Gen Z photo shoots. What does this kind of tell us about where brands are going and how they're using lore and nostalgia and breaking away from their previous legacies? And what do we think this means going forward for brands?
Honestly, I have no idea, but that's my life. Now, I think there is an interesting space that has opened up in the last couple of years where you bring in stuff from the past and you combine it with things from the future, innovation, to create new things that tap into memories from the past, but at the same time solve problems in different ways. Recently, my mom was in the hospital and they brought her a radio that was all old-fashioned. It looked like a radio from my grandma, but it was all digital. It was all like brand new. It was wonderful, and she loved using it despite her being very anti-modern technology and stuff. And it was clearly how this spoke to her by combining the old memories from radio she had with this new way of listening to radio. And I do think there is, like, also from a design perspective, a really interesting space there on how you can combine old things with new solutions and then create new experiences that tap into things that have been already here. But I still, being a user researcher, I insist on there needs to be, like, problem that you're solving, like something that you're approaching in a different way. And and I had that recently here at home, where my wife has a LP player, you know, like vinyl, and my son, like, he's 16, but he had never seen that, and so it was like, how do you use that? So we had to show him how to use and how to listen to an LP, which was an interesting experience. And while he was doing that, it was like, oh, I would like to have a Deftones LP to listen to that. And we were like, but you have it on Spotify and all that stuff, right? Why do you need that? And he himself said, like, well, this is a much more conscious way of consuming music. If you listen to an LP, you're not just putting something play and you're doing something else. You're actually taking time to listen to that, right? Which brings in an old element from music listening that is almost gone nowadays into this new world. And that was really interesting. So I think brands can tap into that if they're really smart about it, how they do it.
And the interesting thing about the LP analogy thing is that you're forced to listen to it the way that the artist intended.
Oh, yeah.
That's so true. So it completely flips. So you get so used to the notion that I'm going to be in control of this, it's fine. And, you know, I'm going to be in control of my TV viewing, I'm going to be in control of what I listen to on Spotify. LPs flip it back to a much older way of responding to what the artist was actually thinking about. And a lot of the nostalgia stuff is people desperately trying to find a way of not being so like befuddled by having to make tons and tons of decisions and, you know, having to deal with lots and lots of technology. And I think what you said, Javi, is really interesting, that you don't get that just by going, hey, I'm Nokia, I've released the 3210 again. Anybody want to buy a 25-year-old phone? It's about how you go, do you know what I love about the 3210? That's what I'm going to make in my new phone. That's what I'm going to make with my new technology. It's your point about, you know, synthesizing it.
And I think jumping back on what you were saying just a little bit, it's kind of with the busyness of kind of all kind of tech things, we mentioned AI, stuff being slightly, I guess, potentially more fake on the internet, on the web. I feel like stuff like, you know, kind of vinyl, LP, and on the other side, I think a lot of kind of film cameras are coming back now, especially in my generation. We're all kind of back onto film. There's no kind of chance for face tune or anything like that. You really just capture it. You capture the moment, and then you don't see it again, and you don't know what it is until you've printed it out. And so I think it's the same stuff you're talking about. It's kind of, with all the noise that's going on now, it's kind of a way to, I don't know, to tune that down a little bit.
Yeah, look, I just have maybe a question I'm just asking myself. I don't believe this is sustainable. I don't believe this is a focus here for them. It's just probably to address a certain need, I guess, maybe for some people who are feeling overwhelmed with all the highly connected world we're in. Just to serve for that, and then people can have maybe an opportunity once and there to just disconnect, kind of retreat, right? I can see, for instance, you have some areas of the country. So I'm based in Abidjan, in Ivory Coast, in West Africa. So there are some places where you can go and have an experience over a weekend or a week, and you don't have anything. There is no cable, so you don't have TV, you don't have internet. and you highly encourage, you know, to also leave your phone behind, and just for people to have an experience, you know, to be connected. And the reality is today you can see even families sitting all together on a dining table or something. Yeah, so everybody's just focusing on the phone, right? So I think there is a need. There not that necessarily people want to live like that, you know, every day, but I think there is probably maybe a need they're seeing for people who want to somehow maybe here and there to disconnect. Mm-hmm. That's the only comment I can see from that. But I don't believe it's really sustainable as a business. Maybe your side, guys, but here I don't see that.
that's actually one of the things I wanted to point out, because I think it's a really interesting kind of geographical thing on this a little bit, which proceeds through Label Sessions life. We talk constantly talking to people around. And I do, you know, there is a cultural thing right now in Europe and America in particular, where people haven't been very excited about the future, and they're mostly scared about the future. But and I think it's like the hard data on that. Last year, I think, was the first year in the history of the cinema where all the top 10 films in America and Europe were sequels. So we kind of reached a point of stopping being excited. There's a great writer, Ted Gilmore, who writes about this a lot. It's kind of stopping of generating future culture and such like. But one thing I know is already, is there is this deep angst about the future and failure to be producing things with, you know, excitement around the future when you talk to people in Europe and America, large parts of the world. But you don't get that when you speak to leaders in the Middle East, Africa in general, say, Fuzlin. A lot of people are much more kind of like, well, they've definitely got a vision for it. I think there's an interesting, there's a genuine, I think, and I also wonder whether we're kind of at the end of a phase, because I do think we're getting to a phase where people are either reacting against AI and creating like a vision of a new future, or they're embracing it, or we're flying to Mars, or we're definitely not going to. And I wonder if we're sort of at the end of a sort of cultural moment on this.
Speaking of technology and sort of the implications and where we're going with the future, Microsoft just announced a major breakthrough in quantum computing this week. And quantum computing announcements seem to come very disguised in other sort of announcements. We saw the big Google one, sort of like a line at the end of a press release. And similarly, we've seen this Microsoft one, which is a huge jump in technology. But what are the implications of these kind of fundamental shifts in technology capabilities when we start planning for what the future looks like? Because arguably we end up in that space where we are planning for things and realizing we're behind the technology before we even start.
Well, there was a weird thing in all the hype in the press release that was surrounding Microsoft, which was one of the scientists said, it's going to start doing calculations that would have taken decades, and we're going to be down to years. And just the thought that there were still projects in the world where things still took years was a complete jaw drop for me. I mean, and I think the Microsoft thing is amazing, because it just makes you remember that there are still things, we're still trying to solve some really big problems over extended periods of time. And so much of the technology that we use is to solve little things that happen right in front of us. It's just fantastic, this idea that there's a huge thing that still needs solving.
I think the quantum computing one is one that is, for a business leader, rather difficult to prepare for right now, because we're talking here about the dimension that would be, like, if you can do quantum computer at a mass scale, it's like similar, like if we would invent fusion energy or something like that. It is like, that's not AI, I have ChatGPT and create a couple of funny emails or pictures or whatever. Is it like this would change the world and how it looks like, starting from very small? Because then, okay, what you used years before, now you can do faster, but you can also move it down to smaller things, right? If you, like, very simple thing is like encryption would be completely useless, right? You could, like, with a quantum computer, you could, like, crack any code within seconds, right? So it would change fundamentally the entire way we would have to build completely new technologies to counter that. And so obviously it's still rather far out, even if they claim it's a couple of years. I don't believe it's that fast, but But this will change pretty much everything. Because if you think about like how much is based now on computing power, right now, and all of that speeding it up by factors of millions, right? Like it's hard to even grasp what this means. So these announcements, I think they're kind of tacked on somewhere because they're not, they're very important for the science, but for real world, it's still far out.
No, I totally agree. And especially, you know, the power that you mentioned, I mean, Fuzlin, you're in Cape Town, and so in South Africa, you know, most of our countries are going through some challenges when you're like, no more infrastructure for electricity. I don't know if it's solved in South Africa, but in a couple of years, it was really a challenge.
Currently sitting without electricity, so yes.
imagine South Africa is one of our largest economy across Africa. So then what about the rest? So then how do you bring that? Definitely there is a need, you know, whatever that can help accelerate, you know, all the key issues that we have. I believe there are tremendous applications, you know, even for us, mm-hmm. that would probably help, you know, move faster in whatever issues we're trying to deal with. But then infrastructure-wide, how do you take them in countries, in an environment like ours? That's the challenge. It's really a huge question mark for me in terms of cost of access, infrastructure, the power that it needs to run that. So it's fancy, but let's wait to see what will happen.
Do you think it's going to wind up being a benevolent technology? Do you think this is going to be the one finally where people go, do you know what, we're going to develop some medicines and make some food, and it's going to be fantastic?
I believe that no advancement in mankind has only been used for good. You always find an evil application for it. It seems to be in our nature. So yeah, no, I don't think so.
And it's usually the first application, right? So the evil application is usually the first application, and then there's so it's...
That's the saddest part, yeah.
Actually, the timing thing is maybe an interesting thing just to mention, because I think, you know, if you look at any kind of big future thing, you can kind of look for which assumptions do you currently make that might be dangerous, and then you can start thinking about where the thing might be happening. But I do think there's kind of an interesting just topic for boardrooms to be talking about just now, which is kind of how badly or how dangerously certain brands are responding to AI. Because I don't want to call out anybody, but I don't know if you might have some opinions in terms of what's happened with Google recently. But in terms of the Google search, Google have broken search in anticipation of AI breaking search. You see what I mean? The service is certainly, unless you kind of scroll down, it's kind of unusable right now. Mm. I do think it's kind of interesting in terms of just a lot of very sophisticated businesses. I mean, they're not, I called them out because, you know, they're the most public example. But there's a lot of sophisticated businesses whose products are definitely worse right now than they were 6 months ago because they've advanced AI features that don't work.
Yeah.
There's a real case study. Like, how has that happened?
But that's exactly what I meant before. And that it is the case for Google and for pretty much all the other companies, is if you don't start with a problem, if you just start with a technology and you go like, okay, what can we do with this new technology? Then you come up with weird stuff. It's like the magic wand to help you write an email that doesn't sound like you wrote it. And then you're like, oh no.
Yeah.
And then you invest billions of dollars to develop that. And in the case of AI, it's not the development that is the most expensive part. It's actually running the models and then scaling them, which consumes a lot of power and a lot of infrastructure. And so now you are laying off people so you can invest in that infrastructure that no user really wants or uses. And so you're shoehorning that stuff into your product. And so you end up with what you just said. You have worse products than before. Because you didn't actually look at the problems that need to be solving, and you invested a lot of time and energy in that. If you think about it, the flip side, for instance, YouTube has developed with an AI translated audio, which is amazingly good, and which now can make like millions of videos accessible to anyone, no matter what language you speak. Right? That was a problem. It was a problem that you would get a lot of content in languages you don't understand, and you used AI to solve it. And so that can be magic. And if all companies, like, or if companies slowly start towards realizing that, let's start with the problem instead of the technology, then I think we will be good. But right now, I agree. We're in a place where a lot of products are worse than before.
Mm-hmm. But is that because where AI can really make a difference is in quite dull stuff? AI is brilliant for governance and, you know, sorting data and all of that stuff. And that doesn't come out very well on LinkedIn. You know, you can't make a post out of governance.
And so, make a post out of saying, like, now all videos are accessible to anyone that doesn't speak English. Like,
that's great.
That is sexy. Yeah, some applications are maybe rather dull. That's possible. But I don't know if that's really the thing. I think it's everybody is racing to have AI in their products as if that's like the thing that will define if your business survives or not. And I do not necessarily agree with that. But integrating it in a good way can obviously have advantages.
I also think there's an interesting thing here as well. And Rob, actually, you see this in the marketing world, I think, in particular, whereas a lot of leaders have actually adopted a kind of compliance mindset. So the compliance mindset is there's a new thing and I need to comply with the new thing. So the new thing is AI, so therefore I need to have things there. Yeah. In the marketing world, it becomes the new thing is performance marketing with various different new social channels, and I need to do that. I had this fascinating conversation because I went to an event, I'm based out of Edinburgh, and I went to an event just end of last year, which was in the whiskey trade. And it had some really, actually quite interesting, but quite kind of, you know, trend-focused presentations on how Scotch whiskey was going to conquer the world. And there was this old guy I was sitting next to, very sophisticated old guy. But he clearly had a very big job in the whiskey industry, like sometime in the past. And he said, "I think I don't understand about the industry now is, it used to be, we were very successful at expanding globally. And it used to be, if we wanted to conquer a new market, we would pick a team of people that we thought were pretty smart. And then we'd say, go and, you know, grow Canada or conquer America with this whiskey. And we'd see them in 6 months' time. And they'd come back and we'd go, how is this going? And then we as a senior team would make a judgment around, should we say to go on and keep doing that? Or do you think you're not doing very well, in which case we should switch someone else in? Whereas now we've got this business culture where we're all constantly reporting on very tactical things. And then it's almost like the big thing of like, how are we actually responding to AI or what problems should we actually be focusing on just now becomes quite a quiet conversation at senior tables. It just becomes very focused on tactics and activity rather than the fundamentals.
Yeah, I mean, in one of the town halls, the CEO of Google was asked, what is our vision? And the response was AI. And people was like, how is that a vision? How does that make sense to anyone? It goes exactly in the direction of what you said. It's like suddenly you're discussing about these small things instead of like grasping the bigger picture.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me, it's not really related to AI, but again, adoption of technology. I've seen it a couple of years ago where there was a trend, every financial institution would want to say, I'm digital bank or digital financial institution. And people would see it as a trend. And as Nick was saying, so if you are not saying that same, you're not having that same language, then people will see that you're not up to speed. Right? Mm-hmm. So you will see a CEO come in and say, we're moving towards digital, etc. But the reality is, when you look at really what they're doing, there is nothing of digital in it. I mean, there is nothing. They will just maybe some of the processes they will put online, and for them, that's it. They go for the digital. And the same is happening in the AI world. I mean, there are things we just need as a trend. So we need to figure out, we need to build, we need to buy whatever we have capabilities, you know, build some models, say, okay, we also are doing AI. But instead of just sitting there and then reflect on what is the problem, as you know, Ravi was saying, what is the problem that we're solving for? And implement it, you know. So yeah, I think that's like just it's a cool thing today. Everybody's talking about AI, and if you're not, then you're not following the trend. Unfortunately, that's I think what's happening.
It's hype, but it's also a model of things. I think I say it's really interesting, Rashid, in terms of if you look at fintech as a sector, an area, and you look at how bad American banks have been at deploying innovation. And you look at how, but also as a counter, look at how good sub-Saharan Africa has been, or the Middle East has been. And what you realize, I guess, is actually it's kind of the same point we're making here, which is actually the kind of executive signing up to an agenda and trying to deploy it down through the organization is really hard to sustain over time, because essentially you have to spend huge amount. You have to get a huge fund to sort of push through the organization to get to something through that mechanism. But, you know, and Visa and MasterCard have been the heart of this in various parts of the world. Actually, the kind of more user-focused, problem-focused agenda, if you kind of enable teams to go and solve problems around that using new technology, you kind of much more quickly start to get to much more scalable innovations. It's kind of slightly counterintuitive, I think, to the kind of sort of MBA innovation agenda, but actually it's sort of some things we've kind of forgotten in innovation culture that are actually really important.
To wrap up and to finish off, we always like to ask what your cultural pick of the week is. So this is your music, film, design, a book, something you found that has inspired you this week. So let's kick off with you, Rashid. What has been your inspiring piece of culture this week?
Yeah, so really, I don't think culture thing, but a podcast. I'm listening to a lot of podcasts, but
is it this one?
I'll add it to the list. So I'm sensing more, you know, especially when I'm either driving or working out or something. So then I just love listening to new things. So different topics, really, be that can be spiritual or that can be even new areas. Like currently, I'm super interested in, you know, how do you invest? But investing in that can be stock or whatever that is. You know, some of these investment, ethical investment as well. Yeah, it's something that is also just attracting my interest currently, picking my attention. So yeah, I think that's the one thing. Like new areas already, not definitely in my daily, I would say, area of focus, trying to learn new things.
Nice. Javier, your cultural pick of the week.
I have discovered the new album from one of my favorite bands, The Cure, and I have listened to it on permanent loop. It's absolutely amazing. I can highly recommend it.
Fantastic. Rob, over to you.
This is a dumb one, but the Saudi Central Bank released their new symbol for the Saudi Rial this week, I love typography. It's a really interesting piece of design. It's kind of small and seemingly insignificant, but it changes the way that you look at a currency if it's got its own symbol. And the old symbol was the word real written in Arabic. The new symbol is this kind of weird, semi-Kufic, really modernistic looking interpretation of that. And so it's just it's a really smart piece of design, and it repositions that currency in a really interesting way. It says it's not just the currency that you exchange at the airport when you arrive in Saudi, but it's a currency that gets traded because it's got its own symbol. So I think it's really important.
Definitely.
Amazing. That's our first currency symbol as a cultural pick of the week. So,
it's kind of a weird one because I was in London this weekend. So I went to the White Cube in Bermondsey. That's a nice gallery. But it's got a fantastic exhibition just now, if you can get to it. Most people listening aren't in London, but you can do. And it's Theaster Gates, but it's an exhibition on Malcolm X, but through the eyes of Japanese journalist, or a particular Japanese journalist. So it's a lovely kind of mistranslation, not a mistranslation, just a different view of it anyway than you're necessarily used to seeing.
On my end, we're on the middle part of all the different fashion weeks going on. So it's really interesting seeing how people are kind of exploring what they're seeing. Perhaps sometimes you see a kind of cultural trends kind of trickle into kind of design, or some people are using creativity and going kind of doing building that up in different ways. So seeing that, and very excited to see what's going on in kind of Milan and then Paris coming up.
Keisha, and thank you to everyone for joining us today. We hope you've all caught up on the world of innovation this week. If you want to get access to label sessions for your brand or have your teams mentored by our leaders, get in touch via our website or any of the social networks out there. See you next week.